Hey.
Hey, how are you, man?
Good. Well, I heard you say this is going to be a short call.
Yeah, actually, I just realized like I just jump off one call, but then I see that there was another one back to back. But like I'm gonna be, I don't know. There's just too many calls, you know.
Wow, you're a busy guy. Well, I'm good for you. Good for you. I guess you're spinning a few plates, right, with Speculoger, and I did want to do a Speculoger thing at some
Yeah,
point.
I think it would be cool. So for example, I did 1 2-hour session with a friend who came up with a cool idea, and then he built a little mock-up in V0 with static data. And I asked him like, is there anything you want to build? And then we do a 2-hour session, and if all goes well, by the end of it, you'll have an extra little piece of code on top of it that works, basically, and you understand a little bit more the spec-driven development approach.
Yeah. I'm keen to do that. Like the thing that bothers me, I've got real FOMO around that whole, like you hear developers who say that, like, yeah, I've got some agents going overnight and while I go for to the gym that the agents are running.
Yeah.
When I'm using an agent, it's just like, I ask it a couple of things and then it stops. Have you managed to like run the spec ledger overnight and you come up with and in the morning
So
there's a fresh new implementation.
months ago they had this like Gastown Spice Must Flow, these Dune references with like the ideas of keeping agents in a loop if they stop until the task is complete. Even lately, auto research is going berserk everywhere about people like you give it some constraints, some experiments to run, and it iterates against those goals, and overnight you get like, I don't know, 45 50 experiments run. I'm just making up numbers
What
here.
is auto research? Sorry, I didn't catch that.
Auto research is from that ex OpenAI guy, and that the guy who coined the term vibe coding. I'm afraid to mispronounce his name, Karpathy or
Andrei
something.
Karpathy.
Yeah, so he released auto research, and he said like he does a lot of LLM fine-tuning manually and finds optimizations based on how he understands the algorithms, and he basically formalized the process, and now he has LLM agents executing this, and he says he already had a highly manually optimized stack, and the AI found a lot of improvements overnight. They talk about numbers, I don't remember them, like
Yeah,
30% improvement.
this is the workflow I feel like I'm missing. I mean, do you do that sort of stuff with Speculator? Get the agent working all the time, or
I mean, if we continue a little bit about auto research, it's very interesting because people are taking this from fine-tuning models to actually building out features as well. And so you see a lot of posts on Reddit and LinkedIn and everywhere from people saying, I took auto research and I made it work on this like product feature. Like I think there was one famous company, I don't remember the name, but they had manually fine-tuned templates for their template engine. I think it was Shopify. It might have been Ruby. I'm not sure. And they had auto research improve the performance of those templates. So it basically can work on all kinds of like it's a framework. It's a bit like Ralph Wiggum. It's kind of a loop to get that going.
okay, I feel like I need to try this. I mean, you
But in
mentioned it,
terms of
but
your question that you
yeah.
asked 3 times already, which is, have you set up agents to run overnight with Speculedger? And I feel like I'm not like,
Oh
I
man,
told you
you're
this
just gonna let me
before.
down.
I just told you this before that even if I write the specs and somebody else builds it, it's not up to my expectation. Even last night, I did something really fun. There's like, I use a certain SaaS and they have a CLI, but it doesn't expose some of the UI features. You have to go to the web interface to click on this, then go there. And it's very annoying because I have to click a whole bunch of buttons to just see the error message. Plus, it's then beautified, but it doesn't actually give me raw data. And ultimately, I need that data back into the shell to give it back to my agent. So to go and click buttons and then to copy out data, put it in the shell, it's annoying.
Yeah.
So the agent dog, Cloud Code, really cleverly found a whole bunch of curl endpoints. I think maybe from public API specs. And it does a lot of like, it fetches my credentials from the credential file. It puts it, you know, does a curl with the authorization like bearer token. And then it finds the details. But there are so many curls and then sometimes makes mistakes that I just decided, hey, I want to capture all those curls and put them into a CLI, like a Golang CLI. And just to come back to the point, right? I started with first documenting like some markdown so that I could point the agent to it. Here's how we did this particular step. These are the curls you do. This particular step. These are the curls you do. And so I took that doc and I gave it to Speculedger, say, write the user stories. right? As an engineer or an AI agent, I need a command line interface to, you know, trigger mm-hmm. this particular action and to go fetch the logs and to get the error messages and things like that. Mm-hmm. So it's not like GitHub Action is something different, because GitHub Action CLI does this beautifully, right? So anyway, I got SpecLedger to write the user stories. Then I went one step further because I had like 2 weeks almost of me doing this. So I went and I told it, now you have the user stories, you have this initial thing. Now go through all of my cloud code sessions, look for this particular API endpoint and find any usage scenario where this was being used and what was the usage, what was the use case, how was it being used, why was it being used.
That's
and
pretty
is it covered?
To make it look through your cloud sessions, but carry on.
And yeah, I mean, like I said, I am not using the automation enough and I have way too many tokens right now. So I'm like, just go ahead and use as many tokens as you want, because I'm running out. Like I'm hitting the end of the week and I still have like used only 40% of my tokens. So just like over 2 hours, just go and explore. And it found like three or more usage scenarios where the AI agent was like, yeah, your document talks about these things, but there's a couple of cases where the agent was trying to do this and it didn't work well with the curls. So it added those in. And then ultimately, I had a beautiful spec, right? I had a wonderful spec. This is the CLI. I have my whole design of how I want it. I wrote the plan and there was just like 40 tasks, which like in the past, I would hit 80 tasks, right? And after 80 tasks, I would say 80 tasks is too much. It will definitely go RE, will not go well. And I included E2E, like it uses Golang. So it uses VCR cassettes to like replay HTTP, because I'm working against an API server, right? So I'm running end-to-end.
VCR
with like,
cassettes, I've never heard that. I've heard of HTTP test.
Yeah, I think it's using like a local HTTP test server, but it's replaying responses from like cassettes, from like on disk snapshots of what the API returns, from what it observed in the past. So wonderful, right? 40 tasks, VCR cassettes, end-to-end testing, CLI fully defined. This is perfect. You should go to sleep, right? And you should just let it run. But, you know, 40 cloud takes maybe 30 minutes to implement this stuff, right? Very fast. And then It finished the first session. I think I did cut off after the spec, but I did keep the same session because I'm using 1 million tokens and I was only at like 15%. So that's like 150,000. And if I hit 20%, that's 200,000 tokens, then I'm already at like 50% of my 400K. Even though I'm on 1 million tokens, when I hit 20%, I usually clear it, because even if you have 1 million, if you go over 20%, it starts to degrade.
Are you using Sonnet or
Opus? I'm on Max, right? So I'm on like on Opus 4.6 with 1 million token context window.
Yeah, I got FOMO because it's like in Copilot, like Opus is 3x. So I don't click Opus and hence I'm not getting the good stuff.
Yeah, so what happened then is it completed the task very quickly, implemented the CLI. I asked it to use the CLI and it did great. Like I gave it the original curl scenarios and it says, run these scenarios with the CLI, and it did everything and it worked wonderfully. And then I asked, any divergence from plan? Well, yeah, the plan said I should put everything under package, Golang directory, but I put it all under internal, which means it's an internal module. You can't use it from other Golang library as a library, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. I say, okay, not a big deal, but why did you divert from plan, right? It's, oh, somewhere it said something like, it didn't put it where I expected it. I guess the agent decided this was an internal utility and therefore it shouldn't be an external contract. Therefore, it needs to go in internal. This is a diversion from plan. It pisses me off, right? Because I give you a very clear plan and for some reason you do it differently. Then the second thing is, all right, now run the end-to-end, run the end-to-end, right? With clearly told you to build end-to-end. Oh yeah, no, end-to-end were marked as out of scope. What are you talking about? It wasn't out of scope.
So this seems to be a theme. We've talked about this before, where the AI doesn't quite do what you want it to do.
Yeah,
so do you think you're getting any better at controlling the AI from going off-piste?
I haven't built the Gherkin integration yet, right? What we talked about, BDD.
Do you think Gherkin will pull it straight?
Hopefully, because it should write them first, right? It should write all the BDDs first, and then it shouldn't stop until the BDD
Yeah, that
pass.
Makes sense. Like you have your spec, and then you have your test BDD, and then that should be the guardrails going forward.
Yeah, so that's the thing that pisses me off, and that makes me reluctant to let an agent's team run all like loose.
I see what your point is that you don't want to make it run overnight because you think it's just going to go wrong anyway.
But to come back to like Claude has made a lot of releases that make it much easier to leave your machine and then, you know, check in and then kick it back off. I haven't really activated them yet, but like you can slash remote and then it will, it makes your laptop accessible through the app. So you can be on your phone and then you can check if the, what's the status. And
yeah, those features sound great. I mean, unfortunately, my employer gives me Anthropic via like an API key. So all those like quality of life features like voice, mobile, all those features are actually not enabled in my Claude code.
Yeah.
Do you use voice yourself?
Yeah, I did it on the demo, right, with my friend, and I like it, but I rarely use it because to me, while I type, I formulate my thoughts, and when I speak, I will misspeak, and then I have to go back and delete part of the
text. Oh, it's not clever, because like, I think some of them are kind of clever enough to like...
I think, you know, it's a very fine line, right?
Or something.
It's a fine line between being like clever and like shortcutting and clearly seeing where the user what said something and they meant something. Because sometimes it misunderstands me because of my beautiful accent. And then it comes up with this weird word and then it tries to make sense of it. And then it would delete half my sentence. Not Claude Code, but I've seen that happen in some other tools. And I was like, okay,
yeah,
just
dictation
transcribe.
Is always one of those things that never quite works very well. I mean, like, I was just thinking yesterday, like, my... As try as I may to like optimize my workflow, like when I write my to-do list on a piece of paper in the morning, that just seems to work the best for me. Like I want to dictate some ideas, but then they sort of get lost in voice recorder or it never comes back out.
So did I answer your question about?
Yeah,
like,
I guess you did, but like
name.
I need to figure this out myself, obviously.
Can you hit your table? Hit your table.
I. You see,
wow.
I got it on like a stand now. So I listened to the feedback. Thank you, whoever gave me feedback.
Well, it bothered you. And honestly, I also noticed your camera shaking last time.
Yeah, so I fixed that. And cool. Are you going to fix your headset? Are you going to get a Rode headset or something?
Like a proper, what do you mean? Like a proper microphone?
Yeah, like the Rode stuff is pretty good from Australia.
Australia? No.
Oh, the weather's so bad here. How's the weather in Vietnam? Just tell me.
You're the third person who asked me this.
Tell me it's beautiful.
It's beautiful.
Thanks for sharing those Reddit links about the trivy thing. I always thought to myself that one day someone's going to do a sneaky attack with the Git orphan commits. Because I've noticed that myself sometimes, that when I'm messing around the branches and I delete a branch, if you know the commit hash, you can pull stuff out from the nether.
Yeah, it's crazy, right? Like even very early on in my career when I pushed my credentials to GitHub like everyone does.
Not me, I'm not a fool.
Oh yeah, well not yet then. So then you learn very early on that to remove credentials from a Git commit is not sufficient to just like go and rewrite, repaste.
Actually, I've never done it. So what do you have to do? Just delete the repo and start again? Or what did you do?
You have to rotate your credentials. They are leaked.
Okay.
Even if you go and rebase interactively and rewrite history and push that, GitHub doesn't garbage collect those commits. So there are bots that
are watching for
events, and they will find those commits and then will read the data.
GitHub does check for credential stuff nowadays, I do believe.
Yeah, and a lot of, even definitely if you push a personal access token, right, it will immediately go send you a notification like we revoked your pat because you pushed it.
God damn it. That's what I want. I want you to show the pat. I'm trying to actually work. Have you ever worked with GitHub apps? That's the thing I'm supposed to do at work, but it's quite confusing. And I'm just wondering.
Yeah, GitHub apps are my favorite.
Something weird about it.
Way to interact with GitHub because GitHub apps are the ideal way to manage automation because you can create them inside your organization as an app, keep them internal, and then you can install them into repositories. And there's no single, like if you say you use the old way, which is create a machine user, which create an account into your org.
Well, basically a pat. What do you mean?
And then, you could give your personal pat, but usually you don't do that, right? So you create a dedicated.
I mean, people create
automation
an account
user.
For it, but that's
but then you have to pay a license seat for it. So you have to pay for that as a license seat.
Yeah.
And then you have to like find the way to share access to that account. You have to log in to access the pat and control like if you even use this create. What's it called? Granular.
Yeah, and you have to make a long live pat.
It's very, very annoying. And then if you use GitHub apps, you basically can dedicate app administrators within the organization, and they can then modify and request permissions, and then they can be reviewed and applied, which is way more better than a pat.
It is better, but like for some reason, I think maybe it's just there's some disconnect between the powers that be who administer this GitHub enterprise that there's some weird permission problem, and I can't roll this specific.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to be like the first time I worked with GitHub. Not personal access tokens, but actual proper apps. I had full admin, so I could see everything.
Okay,
and I wouldn't want or wish upon anyone to try and roll out GitHub apps without having visibility and like what that
entails. I hate that sort of like dark pattern when you log in and you think you can see everything.
You can't tell anyone to say, go and do this. I need this permission if you can't see what is
exactly
missing.
Exactly. Right? It really, this is the thing I'm hitting my head on lately.
Yeah. So I would recommend create your own GitHub app in your own account and play around with that to understand how it works. I think the most important thing to understand is that a GitHub app has an identity, and it needs to use that identity against an installation to get a token for then doing activity within a repository. So the app identity itself does not give it any permission. It's the identity plus the installation identity. So the app identity plus the installation identity together that you need to use to get access to a repository. That's the only way that you need to get a short-lived token from your installation. And that's basically the hardest thing to understand, because you got an app ID, you got a secret key, and then you have an installation ID, and then you need to get a short-lived token. to be able to do things. And it's like,
that makes sense. Speaking of this sort of authentication, so another thing I'm working on is like we have an estate with like 50 plus accounts. And previously I've always been quite happy with AWS SSO, but I think there's been some advancements. I don't know. Have you ever had I don't know what the new AWS switching user experience is like. I mean, do you ever use multiple sessions and switch accounts?
I've found something that works really well for me, and I have not been following what are the new ways to do things. I used AWS-Vault, which is from InDesigns, but they no longer maintaining it, and it was moved over to another maintainer, which probably is scary about supply chain
attacks. You haven't used Assume or something like that?
Which one? Assume? No. I've heard about other, there was one famous one that even the AWS people were using, and it was something, it was the idea of like you basically have your credential management as a platform, and then you just allocate it to users, and then the users could just very quickly switch roles. It was a service, but then they became full paid. It was used to be free. It's something like Jump or something.
That sounds familiar.
Used that. I use AWS Vault, and I've been so happy with it because it can even run as a daemon. Like if you want to do a Terraform apply, it can refresh tokens in the background. It can it can do a lot of things.
I guess when I have a bit of PTSD when it comes to Vault.
Not HashiCorp Vault.
It's not HashiCorp Vault.
No. AWS Vault is a Golang binary that uses your keychain. On macOS Darwin, it uses your keychain. But if you're on Ubuntu, you have to have a secure backend. And the most common or default one on Ubuntu is Pass. 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 So that takes a bit of time to set up. So I just have onboarded someone a while ago, and he was on Windows, and I told him set up WSL and then set up Ubuntu VM and then use Pass. And there's actually a couple of steps to like set up GPG and all that to encrypt your secrets backend. If you're on macOS, it's all keychain and no problem. You can fingerprint authenticate it. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I've used it like that before. I was just thinking more AWS native solutions. And then speaking of AWS native solutions, I've always found like when you have a bazillion AWS accounts, like grabbing CloudWatch logs from all those accounts and putting them in a one central place, that's usually, there is some sort of like AWS pattern for it, but it's just a nightmare if I remember correctly. Like you have to set up Kinesis. I can't remember what you have to do exactly. And then most people just end up setting up Datadog or something and then paying through the nose for Datadog. I was just curious if you have a go-to way of collecting logs from multiple accounts.
Oh, you know what happens when you set up Control Tower on AWS organization, it sets up this really advanced log like audit account, and it sets up forward like rules automatically. Right. Like the moment you activate Control Tower, it creates like you have your maintenance account, it creates your audit account, it creates your Security Hub account.
Oh yeah, so and then it sets up like a well-architected.
Yeah, it immediately like deploys a bunch of CloudFormation stacks all over the place.
That. I don't think I have access to that in my organization, so that's not cool, is it?
Yeah. And then it creates a centralized log account and it sets up all the forwarding for it as well. I remember that I had to like figure out how that worked to kind of disable things because it was costing money and like I don't know. There was some things, but like I was impressed by the amount of configuration it did to basically fetch all of the logs and across all of the organization accounts.
It's non-trivial when you do it manually. I must say I've done it in the past and it was pain.
So when I onboard, like when I have Terraform onto an org, I usually have my Datadog integration module, it's a wrapper around the CloudFormation stacks that Datadog maintains because they don't maintain Terraform modules. They give you a CloudFormation stack. So what I did is I parsed out the stack variables into Terraform variables, and I can invoke the module and control all of the services that are enabled on the account, like disable everything by default, explicit opt-in, because if you have a Datadog enabled on your AWS account,
all the metrics and
it starts to scrape everything, and then you get a huge AWS bill because Datadog constantly keeps talking to those endpoints.
One thing that we ran into work is that the SLA or whatever for the metrics is actually really slow. I think they like it's about 15 minutes by default or something. So like,
oh, but that's
in production.
That's CloudWatch. That's like the default AWS. You have to go and say I want more aggressive, but then you have to acknowledge that they will cost money.
Yeah.
So the 15-minute one is the default one.
It's not a Datadog problem, to be clear. Yeah. But ultimately, when you set up Datadog on AWS, you see this problem often. Like, why didn't we see this problem earlier? Like, well, this is the default, I'm afraid, the 15-minute lag.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. So basically, just to summarize what a setup, a multi-account setup for AWS, you want to set up Control Tower to bootstrap it. And then,
I mean, if you're happy to live with that Control Tower structure, it depends. So, I mean, it will set up your Security Hub account. It will set up like things for
all
you.
All the defaults.
So that everything gets aggregated, like your findings from all the accounts get aggregated in like a centralized dashboard. That's really nice. I mean, I haven't done that for the last 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, I haven't done it for a while.
So I don't know where they are at now, now.
Like many things in the cloud, there's that cloud sprawl, and then every organization that I work on, it like it gets a bit crufty after a while. And I just wish we could have ephemeral accounts or ephemeral organizations where we just move everything to a new org. But like I guess, well, also at the same time, I've worked in enough enterprises that everyone is absolutely allergic when you say something like migration. Everyone goes, no, we're not migrating anything.
This is a funny thing. When I had discussions about platform with some people, and they were like, okay, so next month we'll finally have everything nicely like migrated, right? And we'll have everything in order. And I'm like, most likely not, because there's like, or there's this discussion about like, we want to go towards this, but we're in the middle of a migration. So if we're going to do this, it's going to like cause a migration on top of a migration. And there's this tendency to be like, don't do that. We're going to wait. And I'm like, it's always like that. Like, you're never done. There's always something.
I wonder if there's like a culture in an organization which says like, that's insane enough to go like, hey, we're moving from AWS to Azure. Like, and we're doing it over the weekend, and all our data is our 2 terabytes or whatever of data is going to be moved. And then every, week or month, they can almost do that again and again and again, because ultimately people get calcified in whatever hosting platform they're on, and they never
can
move.
Isn't that the DevOps mantra? Like, if something hurts, do it more.
I've never seen
it's
it
very
myself.
Healthy.
I've never seen it myself, but like, if you don't like, just the practice of restoring a backup and testing a backup. Like, how many people restore a backup? It's so rare in reality, in my opinion, that people have the rigor to just...
You shouldn't say that out loud.
I know. Hopefully no one at work is watching.
No, like, because the cloud gives you so much sense of security, because we're not doing the on-prem data backup tapes that we have to like constantly restore. We kind of trust AWS backup to work, but they have very clear like, well, architecture... check marks is like, how many times are you restoring your backups? How many times are you restoring a backup in a different region? How many times that's all part of the checklist. If you want to do the well-architected, they're very, very, very long checklists. And
I'm starting to think like a cool startup idea would be like validating that restore process,
there are quite a few. Like when my friend was going towards becoming like an AWS partner with an organization, you have to pass all those checklists. And there was a company he found that did everything. So you just hook it up to your account. It goes and find any violation and then deploys a CloudFormation stack to rectify it. And then he said the moment you stop paying or deactivate the account connection, all of the cloud, it rolls back all of the CloudFormation stacks. Like you can't use the platform to like become compliant and then disconnect it because it kind of like rolls everything back and you lose all of the things. So he was like, God damn it. Like I spent so much time because he was trying to reverse engineer the stacks and snapshot them so that he could redeploy them and things that I don't know, just to do it quick. But there's quite a few companies that do that.
That's kind of a dark pattern. I mean,
Maybe with AI today it would be so fast to do this.
Exactly. Like you could give a role to this Restore OK company called Restore Test, and maybe a subset of the architecture and data somehow. Just
it's very, very
possible with AI nowadays.
Because when you look at disaster recovery, there's so many different strategies that you can do depending on your RTO and your other like requirements. Every service has different ones. Like, do you want point-in-time recovery? Do you want constant live streaming? Do you want complete failover? Do you want pilot light? Do you want to pay? How much do you want to pay? Yeah, so AWS has these white papers because I had to do disaster recovery setup, and they have a very detailed breakdown of like four strategies: pilot light, live, like active, passive type of setups. And there's so many scenarios they're meant to protect with. And the white paper is basically don't choose any strategy unless you have well-defined your RTO, your RPO, whatever. And also, what are your attack scenarios? You can't build a disaster recovery plan if you don't define what are the things that you're protecting against. Is it a hack? Is it an intrusion?
You need to do some threat modeling. I love this thing that I
that's
just
the
took
one.
A screenshot
that's the
of.
White paper.
Yeah. But like what I'm trying to say here is like restoring stuff, a lot of that is quite tedious, right? If AI can run through this exercise without people manually, because like no one wants to do a restore because it's boring as hell and tedious.
But it was actually a very fun exercise when we did it.
Yeah,
it was really fun.
Well, you enjoyed it, but like that's probably just a one-off thing. It's like, I'm doing this for the first time.
Yeah, but it's very important because when we did it, we were like, we had a plan and then When it happened, we simulated it in non-prod, but then we actually did it in live as well. It was like, it's very clear what my plan is. But then when you're actually doing it, there's this all additional stuff that we're like, yeah, but am I absolutely sure? Oh, wait a minute. I need to double check that. Oh, no, this process is actually very cumbersome. Like it was designed like this and I have to do this thing, but it wasn't clear to me how to validate it. So doing it live, even if you have completely automated backup restore procedures, actually validating the plan and the buttons you click is so valuable.
Yeah. Like if in light of this AI era that we're living in right now, if you could just list all the tedious things that we couldn't really automate before, like backup restore testing, if we could just list that and basically prioritize them in a sense, because now these things are possible without dying of boredom, to basically get AI to validate your backup or to bootstrap your AWS account. I mean, let's be honest, like bootstrapping an AWS account or organization with Control Tower, did you say? I forgot the name of the product already.
Control Tower from AWS.
Can it even be driven by automation, actually? These are the things that...
So this is where I'm not up to date because there's many ways to bootstrap your AWS account. I mean, if you put in place, or your organization, if you put in place Control Tower, you already have like a first step, but then you can also hook it up with way more things. Like Control Tower has landing zone. And originally when I tried it out 5 years ago, it was horrible. It was using, because the account provisioning was took so long, so much time, and you couldn't even specify what's the VPC ID. Like imagine that you have this requirement that every VPC ID, CIDR is separate because you need a transit gateway to connect everything or interconnect. You couldn't do that with Control Tower landing zone. You had to define the CIDR range of the VPC that was going to be provisioned in advance in the template. And you couldn't say like when the account gets created, go here and allocate a CIDR range and then create the VPC with that CIDR range.
I can see there's some automation gaps. Like one thing that's always...
That was 5 years ago. I'm pretty sure they already fixed some of that stuff.
I made a video about this, like just closing an AWS account.
They also fixed that a lot. Before it was not possible. There was no API, but they added APIs and everything.
Like, yeah, now they have the API, but still there's like a very, like, it's weird. Like the account is like...
Yeah, the recommended practice for years.
But it's still there for like at least a month or something.
Yeah, the recommended practice for years has been you keep a pool of accounts and you allocate the account and then you release the account once you're done with whatever project that needed the account. There's even a whole...
Release the account, what does that mean? Not deleting it.
No. So you keep a pool and you have basically you allocate the account to a project, provision it, and then when it's done, you basically nuke all of it and you release it back to the pool. So you never destroy it. The account never gets created. There's an open source framework that does that for you. It's been around for like, I don't know, 8-10 years. And it's still one of the most popular ways. Like I talked to someone, he says like, oh, I've been working on like account pool mechanisms like just a month ago. And I said, oh, I remember there was this framework. He said, yeah, that's probably the one I'm using. And it's still the same one.
But why not just nuke it and create a new account in the org? I don't understand.
You just mentioned the account stays around so long. I mean, it's always been problematic to close the account. And
okay, so it's this been is an kind established of like pattern. Working.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. By the way, thanks for sharing that thing about State Graph. It does look, I really impressed by State Graph's landing page. It's so clear what it's doing and how to use it. You know, what you need to do to start, you know, how it advertises value and things like that. Like, this is really good.
Yeah. They've been doing a lot of demos, talking about what they're trying to achieve. I was surprised that because I thought the whole idea of State Graph was to go towards a teralith so that you can resolve all of your dependencies within a single state. But they added multi-state support. And I was like, oh, it seems you changed your mind. And they said, no, that was always the plan. The ability to have multiple state within the individual state and be able to plan everything without mocks. Because if you do that in TerraGrunt, you're going to have to specify output mocks and things like that.
Have you given it well? I mean, you mentioned it because, I mean, I'm guessing that they...
Now it's released, right? It's been released... like last week.
Okay. The blog doesn't seem to reflect that. Yeah, interesting. Whatever.
Because there was a release. I think they released it just before KubeCon. But like, I don't know if they made it open source, right? They said that they couldn't figure out the licensing. And this is, by the way, some very interesting article I saw today, this morning, about today. There's this website. It's a joke, I guess. I'm not sure. It's for fun. But what it does is like, don't like the PASCII license, just let AI do enough change so that you make it look like it's a different project, but it's, and you can relicense it under your own license that you want. So they said this is like in the enterprise today, you don't want to get affected by AGPL, GPL, that basically is very, and GPL in itself, like whatever it touches, you're supposed to then open source and so on. So people, enterprise are very much against it. So any project that's GPL or AGPL usually is a no in enterprise. And so you don't like the license? Great. Here's a workflow. Just fork it, make it your own license, and just run it how you want.
Well, like just get AI to re-implement everything, I suppose, is what you're saying, right?
Yeah, I can share the link. It's a very funny one because I was having this discussion with someone. Basically, honestly, there was this project and I can read the source code because it's MPL, Mozilla Public License, but I can ask an AI to rewrite it in a different language. And where do I need to keep the license? How do I need to keep the attribution if I'm basically rewriting it in a different language? Like, I guess
I've seen
AI is reading all the algorithms.
It. I mean, that's assuming big things. Like, because... I mean, we've been chatting about it. I mean, this is what your Spec Ledger project is about in a way. It's like, I don't think people have figured out how to ship with AI, really, have they? So like,
but you think that the idea of pointing an AI agent to an existing project and asking it to rewrite is not...
I mean, like, it's possible. It's bold talk. I mean, it's talk.
You want me
like,
to share
I don't
it?
Think, I don't think anyone's really done that yet. I mean, it's just hypothetical at this point, right?
At the risk of causing a shitstorm, you just showed State Graph, right?
Oh,
so let me just share my screen.
I'm proven wrong. Like that was,
and that's not even
ago.
Open source. Well, maybe it's, hold on, screen, entire screen. It's gonna. You can see it, right? You can see State Graph, right?
Yeah. I was showing that.
So you see this the landing page.
Yo.
With like sequential orchestration versus multi-state, and see the difference. It's all SQL.
I just love that landing page. It's so good.
Now look at this. Well, he changed it. Maybe somebody complained. Okay. Well, first, what I think is funny, I didn't even realize you need to those squares with the little dots inside. Well, there's dot pattern. I thought this was very funny. Oh, this one is very similar.
Yeah, but like copying a...
He changed it a little bit. Before it was way more...
Copying a landing page is one thing. Copying an actual...
oh, no, this thing works. This thing works.
It works?
Like I actually integrated like the CDKTF, and you see spec ledgers in there as well. So I actually did the CDKTF test generator, and then I run all of it, all of these sample.
So what's your relationship with this project? You just know the guy or something?
This is basically doing the same thing as Statecraft, but it's in Rust and it's open source. And it's just like,
What?
The idea is very interesting because he just re-implements the config parser, reading the original Terraform configuration, and then generates the, and then invokes the Terraform providers directly. So he implements the RPC protocol that Terraform talks with the plugins, right? So you have the Golang Terraform talking to the protocols, and it just invokes the Golang execution core of Terraform, instantiates the providers and communicates to them with the protocol. So this thing does the same thing. It instantiates the providers, and then it communicates them through gRPC. So every CRUD action that you need to do for every resource configuration just initializes, out straight to the provider.
Okay, but there's also like a database aspect to it.
Yeah, so this thing is like state graph. It basically uses Postgres as the SQLite as a state storage. So it doesn't support it doesn't do the remote backend setup that you can do with S3 or all the things.
Is this plagiarism? I'm not too sure how to...
Yeah, this goes back to the original question. Like, this is not even looking at the source code. This is just looking at the landing page and duplicating the capabilities. And when I talk with him, he says the main reason is because they didn't have a plan to open source it. And I really liked the idea. And I didn't think it was that hard to build. And if you can tell, it's all AI. And you said that's all like bold talk about AI rebuilding products. It's a fact, okay? You can rebuild a complete product.
Have you tried this in anger? Is this going to work?
I did work it. There was one thing that I discovered, and I'm not sure if they fixed it.
Have you actually compared it with Statecraft?
Oh, no. I mean, honestly, Statecraft's been worked on in private in stealth mode since September. Okay, so a team's been working on that for almost half a year or 8 months. I cannot tell that this project, which is maybe 1 month old, or like a month and a half old, is anything comparable in terms of like stability and features. Yeah. But the fact is that it works. I was able to clone it. I was able to use it with Terraform JSON, and I was able to Oxit apply my Terraform configs, and it was creating against the Terraform provider AWS.
Yeah,
I guess this
is the difference between a commercial product and something that you can just clone out and give a whirl.
Yeah, so you are right in a way that is a pattern that people often say. I think there was a post about it recently, which is people think that they can just rip it and then move away from the well-established and tested library, and they replace it in 30 minutes, and then they spend months fixing bugs and basically...
Yeah, supporting it.
Yeah, so this is the thing I wanted to... Because you diverted me, you said it's a bold claim, but it holds no reality. But this is the website, which is, I think, a bit of a joke. And honestly, I think
I think it was on Hacker News. I think I read it.
Yeah, it's funny how they, put a shit smear on it.
It is slightly... I mean...
It's hyperbolic.
I mean, I actually want Statecraft to succeed, but, when I look at the pricing, when I think about the enterprises that I work with, it's really hard for them to adopt a proprietary product. And how do you pronounce this other project? Oxid or something?
Yeah, Oxid. I should put the state graph on here, pricing.
Oxid is actually, even though it came later and re-implemented state graph or something like that, it actually stands a lot better chance of being adopted because people, the engineers on the ground can just clone it out and try it out. It's like,
so the person that built Oxid, he told me that he has a couple of fintech clients that are looking to roll this out across their organization because they have such a big Terraform state and Terraform is extremely slow. And they are seeing like a 10x or, you know, 20x improvement.
Yeah, I mean, I've had this problem so many times. And the trouble is that none of my projects in GitHub, I don't think will give this a proper whirl. Like, you know, like no one has a private project that replicates, you know, an enterprise.
He got rid of the YAML files,
set up to the, unless I have my home lab somehow expand dramatically.
So one of the things that was missing was the context exposed to the parser, the language parser was missing these internal modules for this type of stuff. So I identified there were several, like in the context, it's missing the path module, the path root, the path current working directory and the workspace name. So those were a couple of things.
I hate those sort of like,
and this also
them?
Was not implemented. But again, I opened all this issue February 18, so maybe you've already implemented. Because I don't think anyone can use this if you don't have these functions, right? You need these functions like file, template file, their name. Like these were all missing on the initial version. So I'm not sure if you actually fixed that. I haven't really looked at the latest commits. Yeah.
And Taco's Guru, you're going to have, you mentioned you're going to put state graph there. You're gonna put Oxide there too.
Yeah. Oh, another thing. He has a platform called Ops0 AI, which is like an agent driven, like for Terraform. So he said that he already has Oxide as a backend, like an execution engine integrated there. So yeah, this is a new website again.
Oh my God.
So when I showed him Tacos, he said, why don't you put Ops0 on there? Because Ops0 is also providing that. So I think both Ops0 and State Graph should go on there and show like the cost. Because like here, it says 10,000 resources at 12K. No idea about like what's the... Is there any... Because the licensing is usually on either the team size, right? If you reduce it, you can see OpenTaco is by user. So if you have a large team, OpenTaco quickly becomes way expensive. Most expensive if you go over 50 users. And then you have the like number of resources. So in my organization, we're around 25K. If we look at state graph pricing, they say 10K. So I'm already at like 12, which is what, $1,000 a year. $1,000 a month is not that bad. If you look
at it.
I'm
just looking at your Taco's Guru repo here. Like you said it was AI generated. I mean, you have the evaluation criteria.
Yeah, it was fully vibe coded. Zero spec ledger even.
Why is that? Can I take over the presentation here?
Yeah.
So I think I'm a little bit confused here. So you basically rate the fact that it has no Kubernetes requirement as higher. I thought that
You know why, right?
No, why?
Why would you need a Kubernetes cluster to run your tacos?
Yeah. But it's confusing in the sense that you might use Terraform to bootstrap Kubernetes. I know.
Yeah,
it's silly,
I know.
But someone might look at this and say, huh?
Yeah. No. The way that it's formulated, it's a bit weird. But the idea is no Kates means, it basically disqualifies. I think Terracube. Which is an open source that you can run on, but you need Kubernetes, right? You can't run it without Kubernetes.
I mean, this is quite opinionated. Like, actually,
it's
on the topic of
why would you need?
Yeah, I get you, but it's
no.
A
that's why
bit,
the weights are open, right? No. But look, if you don't agree with this weight, you just reduce the weight.
Yeah. Okay.
That's why the weights are all configurable.
Really? That's clever.
You go to Taco's Guru. If you don't agree with the weight of this particular item, it's opening. You're only setting it.
Oh, sorry. Sharing
a window. Yeah.
That's really clever.
And it affects the order, right? If you say, like,
order,
for example...
The order doesn't seem to change here in the top.
Change
seven.
OpenTofu. Change OpenTofu weight to zero. Let's say that you don't care about it being Terraform or OpenTofu. Immediately you see HCP Terraform go up. Then change CDKTF to zero. Again, HCP Terraform goes up. It went up three spots. TerraTeam went down one. Yeah.
You need to put this as arguments though on the URL.
I think if you go on mobile, it tells you a little bit more. And even
that's
also
really
on the
clever. I really like that idea. Did you get this? Did you come up with this idea yourself, or you copied another site?
I think I need to credit all my ideas to my principal architect basically what happened is I needed to evaluate platforms to migrate to, and I had to establish criteria that matter to me. So based on my story, I told Opus, like, okay, this is how we've started. This is how we evolved. This is what we have established. This is what matters to us. CDKTF we use heavily, so it's important. And it came up with a bunch of criteria for me. Right. And then it came up with the formula to calculate the score of each platform using weights. I think I might have suggested to use weights. Right. And then I presented a markdown document with the weight calculate, like the weights to each criteria. And somebody said it would be nice. I said to them, do you agree with these weights? And they said it would be nice if we could change the weights and see how it impacts the core.
Nice.
And so I went back to Opus. I said, like, hey, we want to make this, you know, an Excel spreadsheet is going to suck. So I'm going to, like, you might as well build a website. And then,
exactly,
came up with all of this.
Exactly. Well, I love what you've done here. It's really good. I remember we played these agile games back in the day when you were in the office, you know.
Points?
Where you would
poker
sort of have Any sliders poker? in a sense. You'd ask your client, how important is this to you? How important is that to you?
You should see what Opus did with ThoughtWorks Tech Radar, by the way. I gave it the original Tech Radar open source repo, and I told it I have analyzed my internally technology, right? I gave it access to look at the GitHub. I haven't posted it, but I kept it internally. So, and then I said, yeah, but it's very nice to see the Tech Radar and why the dot is there, and we can click on it and we can see a little bit of a discussion why this particular technology is here, because we haven't implemented across most of our repositories. Because you're on a VPN. I don't know.
Okay, that's a problem.
You're planning your holiday to Spain.
It's definitely okay, that's a bug.
That's interesting. So basically, I gave Opus the GitHub repository, and then I was like making it to give a breakdown. So whatever Tech Radar item, there's several criteria for this item to be there, like in that band, and I wanted to show that technology being used in these projects and these repositories. So it created another page. When you click on any dot, it will then show the number of repos this technology is active in.
Cool.
Opus, again, just expanded on this with the ability to give like a slice and dice kind of experience of
I like what you've done there. I should probably use AI for more visualizations like that.
And it's hard to do it. Like, you can try to create a slides, or you can try to create an Excel spreadsheet, or you can try to ask it with a Excalidraw to draw some diagrams. But the real power, even the one that you shared earlier, when you look at like, and we only did the top row of like common agent, like bad practices. When you hover, every single one of them gives like a little interactivity. Like, this type of stuff is so much easier to build with AI. Yeah.
I need to build something like this. I feel like when I interact with my OpenClaw, half the time I'm just asking, like, shall I buy, you know, this product, or is this product better? And half the time when I talk with AI, I'm trying to evaluate some options. So it would be great to have AI just flesh it out a bit.
This was also not my original idea, because the Evgeny Brickman from Gruntworks, he posted a blog on LinkedIn saying that he was evaluating, I don't know what it was, different backup storage arrays for his home system, and he was evaluating them against pricing and features and whatever. Mm-hmm. I'm just making up what exactly it was, but it was something like that. It was something like backup solutions. And he had said, I used AI to create a little like comparison chart and the ability to modify like my criteria. And before I started on tacos.guru, I did go back and search for his blog post, which was on his personal blog, and then look again at exactly what it was. But I didn't remember it exactly right, because it was a little bit more limited than what I wanted. So I did then just take the idea and build tacos.guru. So yeah.
Yeah. Oh, quick side note. If you had the requirement from a client to build out Kubernetes, would you use Terraform or to
Yeah, I think
bootstrap
so.
It?
Yeah.
You wouldn't go CDK? I mean, CDK is better fit for AWS constructs, right? Or AWS services.
I have to say, there's the EKS Blueprints repository, which uses AWS CDK, but it was built before the Kubernetes CDK. So there's a CDK for Kubernetes, and it automatically creates like the L1 bindings and then creates L2s, and it's really nice. What that means is that somebody in the EKS Blueprint repository kind of wrote some TypeScript interface to represent a Kubernetes manifest, like what are the mandatory fields that you mm-hmm. need to do, which is very rudimentary. And that's how they bootstrap EKS clusters with like very rudimentary representation of what Kubernetes objects are like, compared to CDKs, which automatically builds a TypeScript representation of every open API schema in Kubernetes.
Okay, so this is fully EKS, but you would still use Terraform, right?
I really like CDK for Kubernetes to manage my Kubernetes deployments, but like not many, unless you're in the CDK ecosystem, it's probably not worth it, right?
Oh, okay, so you use this to manage your deployments, but not
the actual bootstrap. So what I did 3 years ago was I implemented clusters using some of the EKS Blueprint patterns, which is like they have like builder pattern and other patterns to build with AWS CDK, but I didn't feel it was such a great experience. It was not that good. Terraform modules are very well established. Like the Terraform module for EKS is well established. I do not like it. It's way complicated, but it's way more widespread. I mean,
okay, so
people
if you're deploying Kubernetes on AWS, you would use this Terraform thing.
I mean, I wouldn't, right? I mean, I would land in a team that does it, and I would tell them.
I think I used this in the past, and I thought it was really heavyweight, but
it is very heavyweight, and it's impossible to support every, because you know EKS team keeps adding features. Like now they have completely managed add-ons.
Yeah, you didn't gravitate to using CDK for this.
I mean,
it's just an experience.
My goal with Sarah Constructs was to port the EKS blueprints for AWS CDK to Terraform CDK to get rid of the stupid module. So my goal was to build, and I've already got EC2 instance profile. I've got load balancers, everything. The only thing I don't have, I have auto-scaling group also, but I don't have, I think I don't have auto-scaling group. And I need auto-scaling group to do self-hosted configurations. The thing is, the AWS CDK L2s for EKS depend on every single EC2, every single load balance. Like it depends on so many other modules that to get to that point, I have to port everything else. but I told you that.
You're better off with CDK, surely, if all these AWS contracts
are playing. I think so, because honestly, it's way more intuitive, and it's where the EKS product team is probably contributing. Like they're adding the features into CloudFormation, and then they're adding the feature into AWS CDK, and then somebody from the community needs to add it into Terraform AWS EKS, which becomes more and more bloated and is an absolute nightmare, but for some reason still has 5K stars.
Yeah. I mean, this guy's done a few things. I'm trying to remember all the things he's done.
He wrote the pre-commit
one, which is a great example of why you should use CDK.
Exactly. Right. And the thing is, when he was doing YouTube streams on working on this Lambda module, I showed him CDK for Terraform. I showed him Terra Constructs. I showed him complete bundling solution with complete IAM permissions preset. And he said he really liked it, but he wouldn't spend any time on it.
Well, I think he's made a name for himself for Terraform.
Yeah, and he also shared Terra Constructs.
Serverless TF.
He has a newsletter, yeah.
Yeah.
No, this was, he was building serverless TF, and I was like, why would you do that? And then he built compliance TF, which I think makes sense. He's built it for a year. He went to like 12 or
what
I don't know how many conference talks. It's to, you can select what SOC compliance you want, and then it's going to bootstrap the modules, his Terraform modules, and then it's going to apply the compliance rules, and it's going to make sure that they are compliant your compliance requirements.
This actually sounds useful for at least one thing that I used to work on.
Yeah. So for me personally, I feel this is a waste of time and you should use Aspects and you should use CDK.
Aspects. Okay. Oh yeah. Oh, and actually, that's one thing I need to work on today. I need to prove that some level two level three constructs were deployed in certain stacks.
Oh yeah, you asked me last time.
Yeah, I think we talked about it. But so if I can produce a bill of materials to say that this construct is here, that's what I need to do. I mean, compliance, half the time, it is about giving a nice list of a bill of materials, as I like to call it. I mean, maybe I'm, but I am. What do you call it? Trivializing everything here, but yeah, a bill of materials, I feel, is the critical concept. Okay, cool, man.
We didn't talk about a trivia hack.
We did. I mean,
you mentioned about the fork. No, you just quickly mentioned that you could access fork.
I mean, that's how it unleashed itself. I mean,
it's insane.
All I need to know. Oh, sorry, I can't really share our WhatsApp, can I? Do you have a link to that? Yeah, maybe we can at least put a link to it.
Yeah. So the most interesting, I should put a link there. But the most interesting breakdown, I mean, first it was three events, right? The first one at the beginning of March, where the Clawbot, like the hacker bot, the bot that was like a Clawbot that was configured to find vulnerabilities, basically proved a problem with the way that the Trivy GitHub workflows were set up. I mean, it got some compromise into the Trivy setup, right? That was the first event. They had to like erase, maybe the Clawbot hitting five or six different targets was to hide the actual Trivy foothold, because I think at that point they got a foothold, they got some credentials, and they got access to Trivy, right? And Trivy had nuked the repository and had to re-enable it. Like Trivy was gone. The GitHub action was gone for a few days. And people were like, oh, my Trivy things were failing. Oh, it's because the repo was nuked and things like that, right?
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And then the second thing that happened is people started to realize the binary had compromised. And it started stealing secrets. So anyone who had run the Trivy action had exfiltrated their secrets. Like it had several paths to identify. Yeah, but the people don't understand the impact, because the Trivy binary and the Trivy GitHub action and that scanner live in the Datadog agent, live in the GoTeleport privileged access management repository. It is so widespread across the community that all of these repositories should step forward and highlight how they were affected by the hack, if at all.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to mention names, but I know some big enterprises use Trivy, and I don't want to even think about what the hell's happened there.
Yeah, so
luckily I did search around GitHub to see if anyone in my org was using it, and no one was using it. But we don't use containers very much, thank God.
Trivy doesn't scan only containers. It was a replacement to Terraform Scanner. After Terraform Scan was acquired by,
oh, really?
I don't know, was it Snyk?
Yeah, well, I just did a GitHub search for Trivy, and we don't use it. So,
it's used for IAC scanning. It's used for virtual machine scanning, like AMIs. You can run it on your Linux machine for file system.
I'm guessing you use it.
I have always wanted to deploy it, but I've used it.
Everyone's being quiet now. Like, no, we don't use Trivy.
No, I wanted to deploy it, and I have it on some Jira tickets where like we should use Trivy for this, because we pay for Snyk and CrowdStrike and all this stuff, and then I'm like, why? You know, we can get Trivy. Trivy is good.
But like, okay, let's run through this a little bit. So, okay, say there's a GitHub action and it steals secrets inside the GitHub action flow where the Trivy scan is happening. I mean, usually A, really they're cool, short-lived, and B, like, what would you even do with these secrets? Because a lot of the secrets, like, can you think of something that is looking for, like an Anthropic API key? Or
you just mentioned that you still use PATS.
Yeah, but aren't PATS, oh yeah, on a GitHub, in GitHub, PATS are pretty long-lived usually, aren't they?
And then the second thing
connects very well what we were saying earlier with GitHub, because
apps.
PATS is like a hole in the system, isn't it?
Yeah, but also I don't think using GitHub apps, like the way that I see GitHub apps being used mostly, is you use the app ID and its secret key to get an installation short-lived token. That means, but that's probably in a separate job, you actually do run a short step where you get the
my kid is calling me. I have to take you to school. I think mommy says you were taking to school.
Deflection.
I think my wife told me
deflection.
Okay, I think let's end it there. Sorry, I got to take my kids to school. Just finish your point, and then I'll close the call.
I wonder how effective.
Oh, I think I know what you're saying. The PAT becomes a GitHub token. Is the PAT still exposed? I think you're trying to say.
Right? No, the GitHub app requires a long-lived secret also. So I don't know how you like. You need the GitHub app key to get a token. So you need to have a key exposed somewhere into a workflow that gets a temporary token. And then you can use that token to do things. So you need to really segregate those two, right? Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. So it's still dangerous. It's still like still easy to shoot yourself in the foot. If in the same runner you are getting the key, getting a token, then if that key is still in that same runner, something could exfiltrate it. You should really have like a separate job, a completely different runner, to get a temporary token for the GitHub app and then feed that into your job that needs to do the activity.
And I think there might be. I mean, the risk is here is that someone can get into your GitHub account and go crazy, I suppose, given a...
And can use the GitHub app permissions to do whatever GitHub app has.
I mean, most big organizations have approvals and things like that.
GitHub apps usually, they are very fine-grained tokens, and every single permission that the GitHub app has is way, way visible. Like, it's not like a user that creates a patch and determines.
You're using GitHub apps, which is really hard to set up for some reason.
You should be using GitHub apps. Yeah, it's definitely a lot more
secure.
We all
should be using GitHub tags.
And apparently you should be pinning your commits to your GitHub actions, because that was a long time established pattern, and that's how it got in as well. People are now like, you can't use a SHA because the SHA can be pulled from a fork, and then you can compromise the repo. That's the second problem. Anyway.
Yeah. Okay. Well, anyway, great speaking with you, Vincent.
Yeah.
We'll catch up another time. See you.
Yeah. See you. Bye.